Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Pravishtastu Griham Pitro Parishvattak Swamatribihi Vavande Shirasa Sapta Devaki Pramukha Muda Pravishtas to Griham Pitro Parishvattak Swamatribihi Vavande Shirasa Sapta Devaki Pramukha Muda. Pavishtaha. After entering to but Griham houses Pitro of the father Parishvaktaha embraced Swamatribihi by his own mothers Vavande offered obeisances Shirasa his head Sap Ta 7 Devaki Pramukha headed by Muda gladly. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. After entering the house of his father, he was embraced by the mothers present. And the Lord offered his obeisances unto them by placing his head at their feet. The mothers were headed by Devaki, his real mother. Purport. It appears that Vasudeva, the father of Lord Krishna, had completely separate residential quarters where he lived with his 18 wives, out of whom Srimati Devaki is the real mother of Lord Krishna. But in spite of this, all other stepmothers were equally affectionate to him, as will be evident from the following verses. Verse. Lord Krishna also did not distinguish his real mother from his stepmothers, and he equally offered his obeisances unto all the wives of Vasudeva present on the occasion. According to scripture also, there are 7 mothers. The real mother, the wife of the spiritual master, the wife of a brahmana, the wife of the king, the cow, the nurse, and the earth. All of them are mothers. Even by this injunction of the Shastras, the stepmother who is the wife of the father is also as good as the mother, because the father is also one of the spiritual masters. Lord Krishna, the Lord of the universe, plays the part of an ideal son just to teach others how to treat their stepmothers. Pravishtastu Griham Pitro Parishvakta Swamatribihi Vavande Shirasa Sapta Devaki Pramukha Muda. So as Krishna has been entering Dwarka, he first made his public appearance outside the gates. Everybody came out to greet him. He greeted the populace. Then he gave special greetings to his family members and friends. Now he's entering the palace. First of all, he doesn't just go to his own quarters and turn the television set on. But he goes, first he offers, goes to his father's quarters and offers respects, first of all, to his first gurus, his mothers. So Krishna is showing that it's not difficult for him to have all these different relationships with so many different kinds of devotees. Akrilota Samrita Murti. He's the embodiment of all rasas. In his avatars, his expanded forms, he specializes. Lord Ramachandra specializes in Ekapatni Bhava. He has one wife. And a lot of his pastimes revolve around the trouble that was caused by his maintaining that vow of having one wife. And then his wife got kidnapped. Hare Krishna. When I was as a brahmachari, but thinking, should I get married? I thought, well, I really should consult Prabhupada. So I went to the brahmachari ashram in the Honolulu, Hawaii temple. It was under a big banyan tree, is the building that's the brahmachari ashram, inside the tree. Went in there, took somebody's Bhagavatam off the shelf, picked one at random, opened a page at random. It was the second volume of the ninth canto, and there was a verse describing the troubles that Lord Ramachandra underwent because he had to go to the forest and how his wife was kidnapped, so many problems. In the purport, Prabhupada wrote, and I read it, this shows that the association of women is always the cause of suffering, even if you were God. Something like that. Yeah. I read that, but I was so bewildered that I went ahead and got married anyway. Yeah. I don't figure why I did that, but I should have. Anyway, probably gave instructions. But what was the point? Well, Krishna can handle all relationships. He can handle 16,000 wives. In his other incarnations, he doesn't show all the different relationships usually. He has a few devotees and a special, particular mood in different avatars. You don't hear about Lord Matsyadev, his Rasa Leela, dancing with the gopis or someone else. We don't hear about that. We don't know about any Madhurya Rasa in the pastimes of Lord Matsyadev. But in Krishna's Leela, all the rasas are amply exhibited. And in some places, in some situations, you get to see all the rasas at once. Krishna expertly managing to satisfy all his devotees in all the different moods. Place where that you can see that is here at Govardhan, where Krishna, there are other places in Vraja where there are special rasas. In Govardhan, all the rasas are very vividly manifest. Krishna performs his pastimes with all of his devotees. You might wonder, where does the parental love in Govardhan? We don't hear about Nanda Yashoda coming to Govardhan with Krishna. Krishna will go out in the morning with his friends. He wouldn't take his parents with him. So where is the conjugal, parental rasa? But there is one, at least one recorded incident in the Dhanakeli Komudi of Rupa Goswami. The gopis are confronted by Krishna and his friends as they're climbing over Dhanagati, just in front of the Bhaktivedanta ashram, or just before it, is the place where people would cross over the hill to get to the other side. The hill was bigger then. There wasn't any much of a road then. So you had to walk over the hill to get to the other side. That's Dhanagati. That's the place. That's the place where, especially the gopis, when they had business, they would climb over that part of the hill where the Dhani Rai temple is now, near the Mathura Road. So when Krishna tried to start this pastime of demanding tax at that place, set himself up as the tax collector at Dhanagati, the gopis, he asked the gopis, what's your business here? Were you carrying all this yogurt to sell, so don't you have to pay a tax? They explained that we have been sent, we're on duty, we're doing service, not business. Nanda Maharaj, actually not Nanda Maharaj, but Vasudeva in Mathura was concerned about Krishna and Balaram. And he engaged Bhaguri Muni to perform a yajna for the protection of Krishna and Balaram. Vasudeva did. So Bhaguri Muni and other sages had set up at Govindakunda to perform this yajna. And the gopis were being sent there because this yajna required offerings of milk products. So the gopis were going there to sell the milk products to the sages. Now this has connection with Vasudeva, Krishna's father, who was arranging the sacrifice for Krishna's protection at Govardhan. Even though we don't hear that he ever went to Govardhan, but he's there, his presence is there through this pastime and others. And the same as Nanda and Yashoda. There's all the moods exhibited in Govardhan. And now, this is in Dwarka. But in Dwarka, the intimate moods are also present, just in a different flavor. There is Madhurya Rasa in Dwarka, but it's married to love. Krishna has some friends, but they're his advisors in the court. It's on the level of government business and politics, but he has his friends and advisors. And he certainly has his servants. And his parents are there. Vasudeva and Devaki got to be with Krishna in Dwarka, in Mathura and Dwarka. So all the rasas are there. And here in Krishna's re-entry, we see him reciprocating with all these different kinds of devotees. Now he's entering the royal quarters, the part of the city set aside for the king and his family. Of course, Krishna is not the king. But Krishna's got his palaces, 16,000 of them. Special part of the city. Even today, the ancient cities of India are still set up like that. That the king's palace is in the center of the city, and everything else surrounds it. Or the holy cities, the ruler of the city is really the deity, and this temple of the deity is in the center. And if there's a king, the king's palace is next to the deity's palace. So Krishna is entering his inner quarters. First thing he does, now he's with his family. He's not out on the street with the public. First thing he does is go to offer respects to his mothers. Now, if Krishna only has in each avatar one mother, one father, although he arranged to have two sets of parents. But normally, if he has any, he only has one pair of parents in each avatar. Some avatars appear without parents, but usually no more than one pair. How can other devotees participate in the Vatsalya Rasa if the roles of actually being his direct parents is so limited? There's so few positions available to become Krishna's actual parents. And not only that, the same devotees grab the role in different avatars. Kashyapa and Aditi became Krishna's parents three times, giving less opportunity to others. But other devotees can participate in the Vatsalya Rasa in other relationships. They can be, in this case, the other queens of Vasudeva. They're his stepmothers. They're the co-wives of Devaki. Vasudeva married, here probably says 18, elsewhere I read 16, and the verse only mentions that he offers obeisances to seven of them. Maybe only seven of them were there at that time, or these are the seven principal wives of Vasudeva. Anyway, Vasudeva had, like Prabhupada says, 18 wives, all daughters of King Devakabhoja, all sisters. They all had, practically speaking, equal love on the parental level, on the Vatsalya Rasa level. So Krishna could share that mood with all these mothers. And he considered others his mothers, too. Back in Vraja, he let Putana, the demoness, become his mother. She also entered that rasa. And in Vraja, all the grown-up ladies with families consider Krishna to be like their own son. They have more affection, actually, for Krishna than they have for their own children. But especially after the Brahma Vimohana Leela, when Krishna literally became their sons for a whole year. They thought they were with their sons, they were with Krishna, and they felt love that they never felt before for their sons. Because they already, from before, loved Krishna more than they even loved their own family. This is the successful family life of Vraja. That everybody loves Krishna more than they love their wife and children, husband and children. That's the success, the key to success in family life, is that you love Krishna. Then everything works out. All the conflicts and the shortcomings of material life become tolerable, and one can enjoy transcendental bliss if you actually love Krishna more than you love anything material. But for those conditioned souls who are nowhere near that level of perfection, there are the principles of Varnashram Dharma. How to raise yourself to a higher level of consciousness. The behavior is regulated in order to elevate the consciousness. That's the basic motive of Vedic law, of the Dharma Shastras, to raise consciousness indirectly to Krishna consciousness by stages, to make people civilized, to make the civilized people into Brahmins. And then the other Shastras, the Bhakti Shastras, the Upanishads, certain of the Puranas, certain of the Upanishads, can teach Brahmins how to be Vaishnavas. But first, ordinary people have to be made civilized. Conditioned souls have to be brought up to a decent standard of human life. So they're taught, respect your mother, respect your father. Taittiriya Upanishad, although it's the secrets of the Taittiriya Upanishad are open to very elevated, learned Brahmins. But still, many people are familiar with the basic teachings of the Taittiriya Upanishad. In the beginning, there's the Shikshavali, the instructions in grammar and in philosophical instructions given, not grammar, but Shikshavali means the science of pronunciation. And in this case, the Shikshavali of the Taittiriya Upanishad explains the meanings of transcendental words and explains the duties of a student, of a person growing up in Vedic culture. What does Vedic education involve, basically? It involves learning respect for authority. So the specific instructions are given there. Pitra Devo Bhava, Matra Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava. You should treat your mother, then your father, then your teacher, as if he or she was equal to God. You should make the mother, the father, the guru, your deity. But the mother comes first. This is the natural progression of life. Even if someone has a strong sense of renunciation, and early in life takes to the renounced order, we have record of Shankaracharya took sannyasa at the age of 9? So earlier? I don't know. But we have sannyasis as young as 9 years old. Younger than 9, you can't even read and write, you can't think straight, can't control your senses. But at least by the age of 9, those who are serious can even take sannyas and be trained up under a senior sannyasi. But still, Prabhupada commented in one Bhagavatam class in Hawaii, where do you think the sannyasis come from? The renunciants. They don't fall out of the sky. They're born into families. They have fathers and mothers. The first years of their lives is in grihastha life. Even the great renunciants. So there's use. One has to, even one who is going to become the greatest renunciant and have not even look at women the rest of his life and not talk to them and have nothing to do with them, manage to go live in some secluded part of the forest where women won't bother him. Even he had a mother. And even he was taught, treat your mother like your guru. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became an ideal sannyasi. He wouldn't talk to women. He was, even though he was Krishna himself, who could have paramour relationship with thousands of gopis, and still Durvasa Muni could claim that he's the greatest brahmachari. And it was explained by Durvasa to the gopis how this could be. Because he had no selfish motives. There was no lust in Krishna. Even when he was enjoying with thousands of girls who were other men's wives. So anyway, what was I saying before that? Sorry, I lost the train. Oh, anyway, the Dharma Shastras teach even the great renunciants who later in their life take a vow of complete celibacy that you must respect your mother. Treat your mother as your guru. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who became an extremely strict sannyasi, even when he was liberal to tolerate or even welcome that many of his own followers were householders and had families and children and were involved in making money. He welcomed them all. They were his great associates. But he took sannyas. And upon taking sannyas, he became extremely strict. Even as a grihastha, it said he never joked with his wife. Right? Or maybe only once or twice. He was very sober and strict in association, even with his own wife. But he had his mother, and he definitely considered his mother as his guru. Even after he took sannyas. Just after taking sannyas, he went to say goodbye to his mother. He had left home in the middle of the night to avoid his mother and wife trying to stop him from going. But then he went and took sannyas, and then it was too late for anybody to stop him. And he went back home one more time, not to see his wife, but to see his mother. And she asked him, okay, I have to accept. You've done what we feared all along, that you may take sannyas like your older brother and we'll never see you again. But at least do one thing for me. Set yourself up at Puri, which isn't so far away. And then I can receive news of you, at least, from the devotees who visit. Please do that. And he did it on the order of his mother. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even in sannyas, considered the instructions of his mother as law. And he always showed her respect. And he would appear in his invisible form, in his avesh, to some of his devotees. To, who was it, Pradyumna Brahmachari in his meditation? Whenever Lord Nishananda would dance, Lord Chaitanya would be present. There's a third one, and then Mother Shachi. Whenever she cooked and offered to Lord Chaitanya what she cooked, he would come and eat it personally, and she would see him. So he continued to associate with his mother throughout his pastimes. So if you haven't gotten in touch with your mother in the last 2 years, maybe you should, let her know where you are. And we have more than one mother in this world. This is what the Dharma Shastras teach for us conditioned souls. That we have to learn this motherly respect, not just for the lady who gave you birth, but we have to consider these other women to be mother also. The wife of the guru, the wife of a Brahmin, the wife of the king. If it's a respectable king, a king who deserves respect, then his wife deserves respect. When Romania gave up communism in 1993 or something, there was a violent revolution. Many thousands of people were killed. Finally, the government fell, and they put Ceausescu and his wife on trial, and they murdered them. They executed them on TV. Everyone in the country saw it. And just before they shot her, she said, "Why are you doing this to me? I was just like a mother to all of you." She claimed, she really believed it, that despite all the horrible things they did and the people starving to death and living in great poverty because of the mismanagement of the government, still, she thought that she was their mother and she deserved that respect because she's the wife of the ruler. But that counts if the king is a real king. If he's dharmic, then his wife is his dharma patni, and she deserves to be treated like a mother. And then also the cow, the nurse, and the earth. Therefore, we don't do violence to the cows. Even if we're so uncontrolled we have to eat meat, we shouldn't eat the meat of the cow. She's our mother. Why? Because she gives us her milk. Other animals give milk. And even Ayurveda may say that other kinds of milk may be more suitable in certain conditions. For my respiratory condition, actually, theoretically, it would be better if I took goat milk. Yeah, according to Ayurveda. But my Ayurvedic doctor tells me that you just take cow milk and add a half teaspoon of turmeric, it will be the same effect. But from the Jai Shignimani time, from the dharmic point of view, the cow especially is our mother. She's embodying all the demigods. Her husband, the bull, is the personification of religion. And the cow milk especially is meant for the consumption of human beings, not just for the calf. Usually there's more milk than a calf can take. If the calf takes all the milk, the calf will get sick and probably die. So the cow is meant to give part of her milk, at least, for the sustenance of the human beings. And Prabhupada talks very much about how cow milk purifies our brain, builds good brain tissue, and is conducive to spiritual intelligence. What to speak of just the sanctity of the cow. Everything of the cow, all parts of the body, including the excrement, are sacred and purifying. If you keep cows in your home, you'll see that just that makes the atmosphere very sattvic, just to have cows present. So the cow, his mother, the nurse. It doesn't mean the nurse in the hospital. It means the lady who, instead of the mother, gives milk to the child. She's, because she's giving milk, she's a mother. And finally, the earth is our mother. So Prabhupada didn't teach this to us, but the Babaji's chant a mantra before they do anything else in the morning, before they step out of bed. They chant a prayer to Mother Bhumi. Samudra Vasane Devi Parvata Stana Mandite Vishnupatni Namastubhyam Padasparsham Kshamasvame. Oh, you who are dressed by the ocean is your garment, and you are decorated by your breasts, which are the mountains. You are the wife of Lord Vishnu. Please forgive me for putting my foot on top of you, for stepping on you. And this is chanted before getting out of bed, before putting your foot on the ground. And which foot goes first, right or left? Right, yeah, okay. I try to chant, but usually I forget to do it until I've already put my foot on the ground. After coming back from the bathroom, I remember to chant it. She's the mother. She's maintaining us, giving us all the necessities of life. The father provides the wealth, but the mother is the one who actually prepares and gives the necessities of life. She does the cooking. She does the cleaning. She watches after the family, the husband and children. So the earth is like that. Aham bija pita. Krishna is the seed-giving father, and he's the provider of everything. He is ultimately the upadana karanam, the ingredient cause of all existence. It's all the ingredients of existence, all the necessities of life are coming from him. Eko bahunam yo vididati kaman. Ultimately, there's only one person who provides the needs and the wants of everyone. And that is the absolute truth. Eko bahunam yo vididati kaman. Prakriti, material nature, is not the actual upadan karanam, but in a secondary way she is. Vishnu impregnates Prakriti by his glance, and then she, from her state of formlessness, evolves all the elements. And from her, as the secondary ingredient cause, everything is manifest. All the necessities of life, light, food, water, air to breathe, coming from Prakriti, from her elements. And the earth is the part of Prakriti on which we reside. We don't live in the sky. We don't fly like birds. We don't have flower airplanes to go up to Swargaloka. We're stuck on this earth. We're earthbound creatures. Just like the fish live in the water, we live on the surface of the earth. If we can't have our shelter for our feet on the surface of the earth, we're completely disoriented. If there's an earthquake, you'll experience it. If anybody here has been in an earthquake, the ground gives way. It shakes, it jumps, and it's terrifying that your feet are not standing on solid ground. Even for a few seconds, it's an extremely disorienting experience to be through an earthquake. We depend on this. We reside on the surface of the earth, and we depend on her to hold us up. We're not flying through space. We're flying through space, but standing on the earth. Actually, according to the Vedic view, we're not flying through space. The earth is stationary. And the earth is providing all these necessities of life. We think we get the food from the grocery store, from the supermarket, but it doesn't come originally in plastic packages, already processed. It comes out of the earth. All the food we eat is given to us by our Mother Earth. Just like the mother cooks for the children. If she gets sick, then there's trouble in the family. No proper meals because the mother's sick and she can't cook. Well, Mother Earth is cooking for us all our food. How can you not respect her as your mother. Everything you eat, she's providing. And everything else is being provided by her. The Earth is keeping an atmosphere around itself. Some other planets don't have an atmosphere that creatures like us can subsist on. Go to Mars or Venus and try to breathe the air there. You won't last 5 seconds. You'll be dead. But the Earth is keeping around her this blanket of, just like the mother makes sure that everybody has blankets in the winter. Well, we have this blanket of the breathable atmosphere. Just the right mixture of oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide that we can live in it. She's providing all the basic necessities of life. How can we not treat her as our mother? So Krishna is the leader of all living entities. He's showing how to respect your mothers. There's not just one mother. There's not just one guru. We should have respect for all of our mothers and fathers. Okay, Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Yes. Chaitanya Prabhu.
Hello. It's easy to respect women if they have motherly qualities, but like in the modern culture, the women generally don't have motherly qualities, and how is it possible to respect them as mothers?
Well, even suppose your mother is not so good. I'm not saying your mother isn't, I'm sorry. Somebody's mother is not such a great mother. Still, she's a mother. A bad mother is still a mother. So they may not know how to be mothers properly because of this degraded culture. People don't know how to do the basic things like be a mother or father. Even monkeys know how to be a mother or father. Pigs know how to. And because we're such sophisticated human beings, we forget how to be mothers, fathers, children. Can't even act in the most basic roles that even animals know how to behave in. That's the corruption of human society. But still, a mother is a mother. A bad mother is still... If your mother is bad, she's still your mother. She forgives you. If you go bad, you have to forgive her if she's bad. And still respect her as your mother. So we have to... Matrivat paradarishu. Prabhupada quoted Chanakya. Even though he wasn't a pure Vaishnava, Prabhupada quoted him on this. That you should treat all other mothers who are somebody else's wife, like your, all other ladies who are somebody else's wife, you should treat like your mother. Not just the civilized ones, not just the pious ones, the faithful ones, but all of the other ladies, especially the ones who are married. They're treated like mother. And the ones who aren't married yet, they're potential mothers. Still, you treat them like mothers. Otherwise, what are you going to treat them like? Sister? Wife? You got to have some relationship with everybody you meet. You have to define what's your relationship with every person you meet. You never know. You meet a stranger. You have to define. There's ways of talking to someone to find out who he is and what and understand how to relate to them. Modern culture, especially in my country, America, there's not much social structure. Everybody's supposed to be the same. But in ordinary, proper societies, there's hierarchies. So just like in Thailand, when two people meet each other, they have to find out, strangers meet each other, they have to find out very quickly by asking questions. What's your position? You know, what's your status in society? How old are you? What job do you have? How much money do you make? Then you know how to deal with the person. You don't even have an orientation. How much respect to show and how until you decide exactly who that person, what his position is. That's culture, is to deal with each person according to their position and show appropriate respect. So the Vedic standard is any woman, at least any woman who's married to a man other than yourself, has to be treated like mother. You call her mother and you don't do anything to her that you wouldn't do to your mother. Otherwise, we're going to treat them like something else, and it'll be inappropriate. So even though they're not, don't deserve to be mothers for our own protection, we have to think of them as mother. So we don't think of them as, you know, a potential spouse or something else. Or a daughter or sister. Yeah. It's got to be, got to treat them like something. Sometimes we get offensive against women, and we call them the, you know, the mother of a dog. But that's also not an appropriate way to relate to a human being. Don't go to your problems first, and then not a moment for women.
During the course of your talk, you indirectly made a distinction between a civilized man and a brahmana. Could you expound on that?
Oh, the other members of the Varnashram society, the Vaishyas, the Shudras, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, are also civilized. That's what I meant by it. The Brahmins are the most civilized, but the others are also civilized. I think that explains it, yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you. Yeah.
And people outside the Vedic culture are not really civilized. They think they are. Europeans come to America and they're easily angered because they think they're better than the Indians. But because they have no Vedic culture, they're not really civilized. And they shouldn't be so proud. And the Indians, who've forgotten all their Vedic culture, shouldn't be proud either. Who was Madan Mohan Prabhu?
You mentioned that in Vrindavan, devotees love Krishna more than they love their own relatives, and that's a successful Vrindavan or Vraja family life. And the question is, sometimes in ISKCON, within ISKCON, love towards parents or towards anybody except a spiritual master devotee is almost like a something forbidden or something very undesirable. In other words, when devotees really speak about relations to their non-devotee parents or non-devotee relatives or friends, former friends, then they have to somehow rather justify philosophically treating them properly in a humane way, and the word love is almost always absent from such conversations as applicable towards their parents. In other words, for us to love Krishna more than our parents sometimes not difficult because we don't really feel we need to love them. Where does that concept of love towards our parents who may not be devotees fit in our Vaishnava ethics, theology?
Dan, from Krishna's opinion about it, he never tells us. He's not that envious a God that he says, don't have any affection for anybody else but me. He never says that. He says some pretty heavy things. Surrender to me completely. But he never says, don't have any affection for anybody else. Never says that. A sannyasi has to have affection for his disciples and for everybody. When you take sannyas, it's not that now I have no family. No, now you have 6 billion member family. You know, now you got so many people to worry about. So we have to have affection. Jiva doya is one of the basic principles taught by Nityananda Prabhu. Compassion for the living entities. And your family are also living entities. And you have special responsibility toward them. So they're living entities. They're also Krishna's devotees, even though they don't know it or may not know it. And they've been put in your care. So you have a special responsibility to them, to your mother, to your other relatives and friends. Do what you can, but don't do it at the cost of being dragged down by them. Don't let them bring you back to material life. So Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati is a practical question. Associate so to help them, but don't let them drag you down. So Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur had a problem, you know, with Bengali parents. With his young Bengali disciples, they would try to come and take the brahmacharis back home. So what he would do when such parents came, often I read in Bhadivakash Maharaj's book, he would hide them under his own bed, the brahmachari, and tell the parents, I haven't seen him. I don't know where he is. Yeah. And then warn the brahmachari, don't listen to what your parents are telling you. They're just talking, you know, they're speaking as agents of Maya to tell you to come home again. It depends on the situation. But a brahmachari who's making a little bit of progress and isn't so easily, you know, he isn't going to fall down the minute his mother, you know, says, why don't you come home? I'll bake cake for you. You know, he's not so easily enticed. He's a little bit secure in devotional service. He should try to help his parents and show some decency. And if we're afraid to be dragged down by material association, then we should show respect from a distance. You can write to your mother, even if you're not going to go visit her. Yes?
Thank you. Well, it's a very vast topic, actually, and I have many questions regarding it to discuss. But if I could ask a short question about something else you've mentioned.
Yeah.
Regarding a comparison between Western culture and Vedic culture, that in the West people tend to treat everybody equally, whereas in traditional societies like Thai society that you mentioned or Vedic society, people tend to treat one another hierarchically. Somehow I think it occurs to me that in Vaishnava way of dealing with other people, we're almost like, quote-unquote, closer to the Western standard because we are supposed to treat everybody equally as well. The difference is on a different level as souls, whereas I've seen in India, even now, even in ISKCON, that hierarchy has become so mechanical and so, well, hierarchical
corrupt.
To the extent that...
Corrupt.
Well, whatever, even in spiritual organization, like I was in a temple somewhere and in Mangalarati, and a devotee who was taking that lamp around, he was zigzagging across the altar room, you know, like going to temple president first, and the chief pujari, and the cook, and the temple commander, and then eventually we had only two devotees left. It was a bhakta and myself, and he walked up to us, he measured me up and down, with his, and he turned to Bhakti and gave it to
me. You got last.
Like, almost like, no, I wasn't offended really, but I was surprised. Almost you have to have a badge, you know, coming to Mangalarati with numbers on it. Like, so well, in a sense, it creates this kind of, for such devotees, it's easy to surrender, but their surrender is not so deep, it's very shallow, and their respect is also not worth much. Whereas,
well that's a perversion of the proper concept of respect. What is it you're respecting? What I've read in, you know, written by sociologists of India is that what's respected in India is power. The person who has power. Money is just there for power. The thing that's worshipped in India is power. Whoever's powerful can do whatever he wants and everybody will, you know, kiss his feet. And therefore, if we're talking about the hierarchy of power, that's a corruption. And, you know, that materialistic Indian culture, devotees may bring it with them to the ashram. That's not the real thing.
Okay. Like when we saw Krishna just a few verses before that, when he entered Dwaraka, and he treated, even though he is the Lord of the whole universe, he treated everybody, well, differently, but even the lowest on the rank, they got him. Anyhow, he gave himself to everybody. Yes. But then at work, he worked from that level up. And he increased the extent he gave himself to other people surrounding him. Whereas in our society, sometimes we don't even really care to give any respect to people and begin with respect only when we really have to.
Well, a noble person should give himself to everybody as appropriate to each person. He should understand the appropriate ways to give himself to others, to offer himself, to make himself open to others, and show respect to everybody. Krishna showed respect to everybody as suitable for each. And a noble person should follow that example. Okay. Yeah. Last question. Oh, we're out of time. But you had your hand up.
Prabhu mentioned that although Krishna relates to many queens and gopis, he is an eternal brahmachari.
Well, that was Devasa Muni's claim. Yes, he's the best brahmachari.
Oh. Oh, okay. But you were mentioning Krishna also in this lecture, no?
Yeah. Dvarasa said, that's Krishna. He's the best Brahmacharya.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's Krishna. Could you please explain how
I don't remember. It's there in the Gopaltapa Upanishad. What his explanation was, how Krishna is the best Brahmacharya. I never read the whole Upanishad. Bhishma also said it. Okay, I don't remember the argument. How you can argue that Krishna is the best Brahmacharya. Well, because he actually has no material desires. He's completely selfless. Somebody who has no material desires can be called a Brahmacharya. Okay. You want to ask a question or should we stop? Okay, but we can stop so we can continue the program. Thank you all. Glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki Jai.